The last passage I shall read is from the novel Augustus. At Will Andrews' moment of recognition, Andrews was in his early 20s. William Stoner was in his 65th year. And the passage that I shall read now is spoken by Augustus in his 76th year. We all know something about the career of Octavius Caesar, named Augustus. At the age of 19, he was one of the three rulers of the Roman Empire. At the age of 27, he was sole ruler of the Roman Empire. And for 50 years, he was emperor of that factious state. In his 76th year, knowing that his days are limited, he takes a last vacation on his small yacht down the coast of Italy to the island of Capri, where he has a house and has friends. The whole of the last section is a long letter that Augustus, in his old age, is writing to the only friend of his who remains alive. His old friends, Horace, Virgil, and others, are dead. He has no one. He is accompanied only by his young Greek physician, Philippus. And during the course of this last letter to Nicholas of Damascus, a Damascan Jew, he has been convinced that his life, the life of power, has been meaningless. He has sacrificed himself, he perceives, to the needs of the state, and he is unsure of the cost and unsure of the significance of what he has done. He has had a mild stroke, which he knows presages the end, and which he has concealed from his doctor. This letter is written on August 11th, in the year 14 A.D. Augustus speaks. During the night, I did not move from my couch, but kept a vigil on the stars that move in their eternal voyage across the great dome of the sky. Toward dawn, for the first time in days, I dozed a little, and I had a dream. I was in that curious state where one dreams and knows that one dreams, yet finds there a reality which mocks that of one's waking life. I wished to remember the contours of that other world, but when I was awakened, the memory of the dream fled into the brightness of the morning. I was awakened by the stirring of the crew and by the sound of a distant singing. For a moment in my confusion, I thought of those sirens of whom Homer wrote so beautifully and imagined myself to be bound to the mast of my ship, helpless against the call of an unimaginable beauty. But it was not the sirens. It was a grain ship from Alexandria that sailed slowly toward us from the south, and the Egyptian crew, dressed in white robes with garlands on their heads, stood on deck singing in their native tongue as they approached us, and the musky odor of burning incense was borne to us on the morning breeze. We watched their approach with some puzzlement until at last the huge ship, which dwarfed our own, came so close that we could make out the smiling, swarthy faces of the men. And then the captain stepped forward and hailed me by name. With some difficulty, which I trust I concealed even from Philippus, I arose from my couch and went to the deck rail, upon which I leant while I returned the greeting of this captain. It appeared that the ship had unloaded a cargo of goods at the harbor between Puteoli and Naples, and had been informed of my presence nearby. And the crew had wished, before they made their way back to their far Egyptian homeland, to greet me and to give me their thanks. The ship was so close I did not have to shout, and I could see clearly the dark face of the captain. I inquired his name. It was Pothelius. And as the crew continued its low singing, Pothelius said to me, "You have given us the liberty to sail the seas and thus furnish Rome with the bountiful goods of Egypt. You have rid the seas of those pirates and brigands that in the past would have made that liberty empty. Thus the Egyptian Roman may prosper and may return to his homeland, secure in the knowledge that only the accidents of wind and wave threaten his safety. For all this we give thanks to you and pray that the gods will allow you good fortune for the rest of your days." For a moment, I could not speak. Pothelius had addressed me in a stiff but passable Latin, and it occurred to me that 30 years ago he would have spoken in that demotic Egyptian Greek and that I would have been hard put to understand him. I returned the captain's thanks and said a few words to the crew and directed Philippus to see that each member of that crew be given some coins of gold. And I returned to my couch from where I watched the huge freighter turn slowly away from us and move southward, its sails bulging in the wind, its crew waving and laughing, happy in their safety and homeward voyage. And so now we too move southward, and our less bulky ship dances upon the waves. The sunlight catches the flecks of white foam that top the little waves. The waves slap gently and whisper against the sides of our ship. The blue-green depth of the sea seems almost playful. And I can persuade myself now that after all, there has been some symmetry to my life, some point, and that my existence has been of more benefit than harm to this world that I am content to leave. Now, throughout this world, the Roman order prevails. The German barbarian may wait in the north, the Parthian in the east, and others beyond frontiers that we have not yet conceived. And if Rome does not fall to them, it will at last fall to that barbarian from which none escape, time. Yet now, for a few years, the Roman order prevails. It prevails in every Italian town of consequence, in every colony, in every province, from the Rhine and the Danube to the border of Ethiopia, from the Atlantic shores of Spain and Gaul to the Arabian sands and the Black Sea. Throughout the world, I have established schools so that the Latin tongue and the Roman way may be known, and have seen to it that those schools will prosper. Roman law tempers the disordered cruelty of provincial custom, just as provincial custom modifies Roman law. And the world looks in awe upon that Rome that I found built of crumbling clay and that now is made of marble. The despair that I have voiced seems to me now unworthy of what I have done. Rome is not eternal. It does not matter. Rome will fall. It does not matter. The barbarian will conquer. It does not matter. There was a moment of Rome, and it will not wholly die. The barbarian will become the Rome he conquers. The language will smooth his rough tongue, and the vision of what he destroys will flow in his blood. And in time that is ceaseless as this salt sea upon which I am so frailly suspended, the cost is nothing, is less than nothing. We approach the island of Capri. It shines like a jewel in the morning sun, a dark emerald rising out of the blue sea. The wind has almost died, and we float as if upon the air toward that quiet and leisurely place where I have spent so many happy hours. Already the island inhabitants, who are my neighbors and my friends, have begun to gather at the harbor. They wave, and I can hear their voices calling. Gaily, gaily, they call to me. In a moment, I shall rise and answer them. Thank you.